This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Vigen Guroian. He's a professor of religious studies in Orthodox Christianity at the University of Virginia. I spoke with him on February 22, 2007, from the studios of American Public Media in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in a private recording studio in Charlottesville, Virginia. This interview is included in our show, Restoring the Senses, Gardening and an Orthodox Easter. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
You're keeping me out from this beautiful day, too.
Yeah, well, I'm going to keep you for a long conversation, you need to get things working on that end.
Oh, okay.
Is it a beautiful day?
Okay. Oh, it's beautiful out here. We're going to be in the 60s today.
In the 60s?
Yeah, it's almost like spring. It's a joke.
But wasn't it bitter cold a week ago?
Yes. We had snow on the ground yesterday. It all melted.
Wow. Well, we got up to 40 yesterday, which felt tropical here, but now way back down again. It's getting cold.
We're getting cold tomorrow. Yeah. Actually, the front is coming through here this afternoon. It's supposed to get windy. It's not going to be 60 tomorrow, but it is.
Do you have any questions for me about the show or who our listeners are or any?
Yeah, who are the listeners?
Well, there are 500,000 public radio listeners and 100,000 podcasters. And they're all over the world. And, public radio has a certain demographic. People tend to be educated. Yeah. They tend to be leaders in their community. We have a great range of ages, 18 to 80. We have all kinds of people.
And the podcasters subscribe with you? Is that what they do?
Yeah. Well, they get it through iTunes. It's on all the, I don't understand how podcasting works, but you can get it in all the usual places. And that we just started doing that about 6 months ago and we've just had great, tremendous growth. So that's exciting. So there are a lot of people and it's a real range of people. It's people who are deeply devout Christians, Jews, Muslims, and people who are agnostic and atheist and yet. And yet curious and energized by these questions as well.
Weren't you talking about starting this even way back when?
You
had some sort of project going at the
time. I was doing an oral history project for the Institute, and that's kind of what led to this, because I did about 50 conversations over 2 years, and I had this idea that we could do this on public radio, and it could be intelligent and balanced and inviting in a way that religious conversation in media had not been.
Yes.
So
when did this start, actually?
We started doing monthly. We did some pilots in 2000. We did. We started doing monthly shows 2001, 2002, and about 3 years ago, we started as a weekly national show with about 30 stations, and now we're on almost 200 stations.
Wow.
And, so we're on three times on the weekend in New York City, and. We were on in Washington, and when WIDA changed their, they went to classical music.
Yeah.
And so we, all right. So I'm being told that we need to get to work here. But anyway.
Okay.
It's a very broad and eclectic and diverse audience, but I do, it's one voice at a time, and we don't water down the depths of traditions, and so I really want to let you speak out of your faith and tradition, and I know, I think that Eastern Orthodoxy will be very new and unfamiliar to many people who are listening, and I think that's exciting. So.
Yes. I'm quite sure.
Yeah, but the way I want to do it is the Collegeville way, where it's embodied through your life story and real.
Okay.
Real through your experience, not something abstract.
Well, good. So you've thought this through.
I've thought this through. I've got three pages of notes.
You know the narrative and the path, huh?
Yeah. I've got three.
I don't know if you got those little things, and did you get any chance to read them?
Yeah, that was great.
It seemed perfect. Logical to give that to you because they are on that theme if you want to move into that theme.
And we will talk about some of that, and I also want to talk about your gardening. So, should we start, Mitch? Okay. All right. Oh, it is. Okay. I would like to start with just a little bit about your family's, the background, the religious background of your life, your roots in this tradition, yeah, and your family's roots in this tradition.
Well, you know some of that story. All of my grandparents came from Turkey, Eastern Turkey, the traditional historic western provinces of Armenia. They all left between roughly 1910 and early 1920s, mostly having to do with the breakdown of the Ottoman Empire, World War I, and the massacre of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Armenians, which we regard as the first genocide of the 20th century,
right,
which has been in the news lately as well.
Yeah.
They came from that part of the world. If you were Armenian, you were Christian, and you knew it, particularly in a Muslim world, an Islamic world under the Ottoman Empire for so many centuries. And so with tenacity, these ethnic Orthodox came over here, as Armenians as well as others from Eastern Europe at that period of time that were within the Ottoman Empire. And there was no really distinguishing the ethnic identity from the Christian identity,
mm-hmm,
not necessarily at national identity. Nationhood was just emerging in some of these places, but certainly the ethnic identity. And that when they came over here, as the story goes, and it's pretty true, the first thing they did was start to form parishes, which were the obvious way in which to bring themselves together as a community. Actually, in my own family's case, there are priests in the background, though I don't know enough of the history of that. I know that my paternal grandfather's uncle was, if not the first, then the second Armenian priest in Manchester, England, one of the first communities to form in England. I have a book on that community. It's in Armenian. I know I've read parts of it. There are pictures of him as well as the altar. And that building and structure remains in Manchester. And in my trips to England, I've never quite gotten to that building. I know it's still owned by the Armenian community, and it may well be active, at least occasionally, still. So there is that background. But I did not grow up in a strongly religious home.
Right.
It was imbibed through my Armenian, my dual identity, really.
But you had a sense, I mean, part of your sense of who you were was that you were Armenian Orthodox Christian.
Yes, and part of the sense of who I was my own father, who railed against God for having permitted such things to happen.
Mm.
Not unusual in first and second generation Armenians,
right,
who fled the Turkish genocide, the Ottoman genocide. So there was even that tension of faith inside the household and inside the larger family.
And it sounds to me like you kind of rediscovered, I mean, you are now a theologian and an Armenian Orthodox theologian, and it sounds like you discovered that kind of on your own as a student.
Yeah, in a way I did, but not necessarily so, because there was all the manifestations of Armenian Orthodoxy in my early life. I mean, the memories of being in a church environment which was so utterly different from my ordinary day-to-day life.
Right.
The incense, the images, the chanting, even the oratory, the kind of homiletic style, which, you know, was foreign. I was accustomed to it, but I early understood that it distinguished me from others. I you know, if you dig deeper, you find that I had a strong sense of a need for asking the question as to who God is. Is there a God and who God is? Even though I didn't have quite formal instruction, we moved to Stamford, Connecticut from New Rochelle when I was five. There were no Armenian churches in the area. And at that early period in the 1950s, pan-Orthodoxy wasn't really, hadn't really quite emerged. And what I mean by that is the recognition among all these ethnic Orthodox communities that they basically share the same faith and that we ought to be visiting each other's churches and be welcoming each other's churches. None of that existed. So that, even though there was a strong Greek community in Stamford, I never visited a Greek church, and so I ended up going to a Congregational church.
Really?
Yes. My parents didn't accompany me. they just sent me. Mm. Now, my father grew up in Bridgewater, Massachusetts, where there was no Armenian church, too, and he attended a Congregational church, the old church in the middle of the town square, you know, with the tall steeple, the white church with the tall steeple. So, by the time I was 12 or 13 or 14, I knew this wasn't my faith. Right. This wasn't all of it. And it was because I'd end up in Armenian church on Easter and Christmas and other feast days. And I just knew. And I was asking deep and profound questions about this. I just reserved them. I used to say to myself, well, I'll grow into this in time as I mature. I don't know quite where I'm headed. Mm. This came to a head in college at the University of Virginia, where I began to attend. I would attend the First Presbyterian Church. I would attend the Greek Orthodox Church. I liked the sermons in the Presbyterian Church. It was a great Calvinist orator in there. Right. A Dutch war hero, in point of fact, and went to the Greek church and began to sort it out there. Right?
Okay.
You're
now in Lent, right? Lent started for you on Monday.
We start, yes, mm-hmm. That's right.
Talk to me about when you think about this time, this season, this liturgical season, Lent, heading into Holy Week and Easter. What occurs to you as important and distinctive for you in practicing this that again is rooted in this Orthodox tradition that you did in fact live into?
Even though I wasn't raised in a devoutly Armenian Christian environment, We did eat the Lenten foods, and while it wasn't formal fasting, it was culturally transmitted to me, mm-hmm. and I didn't receive a whole lot of instruction as to why this was being done, and why we were eating the kinds of foods which were non-meat and oftentimes eggs and spinach and other beans, sorts of things that I didn't particularly like either. Mm. As one matures and one begins to ask one's questions about one's religious background and belonging, one tries to make sense of these. And certainly as I look back on it, I realize that implicit in all this was a sense of stopping, considering what our lives are about, making some sort of sacrifice in the way of observing a penitent season in which we re-examine ourselves. We didn't keep the rhythm of Lent. That is something which I'm in some ways learned. Mm-hmm. As I began to read literature and began to attend church services, not only Armenian but other Orthodox church services.
And what do you mean when you say the rhythm of Lent? What does that evoke for you?
For example, the Sundays have a significance. In my own tradition, for example, the first Sunday would be an observance of the beginnings, creation. And in a sense, through the whole of Lent, you recapitulate the story of creation, fall, and redemption.
Right.
These are circles inside of circles, repetitions inside of repetitions. For example, in the Armenian liturgical calendar, prayers and hymns that accompany readings from the scripture, there's a kind of eight-day cycle, at least as I've observed it. It's not been written about, but I'm actually beginning to write and think about it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, the eighth day is the day of the new creation.
Right.
Every Sunday is not only the first day, but it's also the eighth day. We break out of the temporal week, 7 days, and break into the new creation, which is on the eighth day, which is the day of the resurrection.
Hmm. And what does that mean? I mean, is that a state of mind? It's a way you move through time differently?
Absolutely, that's the way I move through time. So the beginning and the end are connected with one another, it's not simply intellectual. It's bodily. It's a rhythm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's another way of counting. It's another way of living through time that is very alien to our culture at present, it seems to me. It's totally radical in that sense.
I think, when you say that a lot of your sense of Orthodox theology that you later turned into practices was transmitted by food or just by experience rather than ideas. It seems to me that that's also very true of an Orthodox sensibility in contrast to maybe a Protestant or Catholic Christian sensibility. I mean, symbols are very important to you. And just as you just said about a sense of time, our culture doesn't quite know what to do with symbols.
Well, let me go back to what I was getting at with regard to Lent and the very end of, Lenten season, Palm Sunday. In the Armenian church, what is the entrance of, and this is true of the early church, you see this in the church fathers, the patristic writings, and in the ancient liturgies. In the Armenian church, is quite explicitly the entrance of Christ into Jerusalem is a foreshadowing of, and in some sense, really, the second coming of Christ also. So on Sunday, on Palm Sunday, you have the second coming remembered. On Resurrection Sunday, on Easter, you have readings the night before and Easter Eve of the creation, the Genesis story.
So it's kind of moving backward in time as well as forward.
Yes, we remember the resurrection. I mean, in fact, in the liturgies, you have that. You remember the second coming. And it's articulated that way in the ancient liturgies and in the Orthodox liturgies, that we remember the second coming as if it has happened. Well, it has in some sense.
Which then makes
in the incarnation and Christ event.
Mm-hmm. Which then makes a different kind of celebration and return to the beginning possible. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, mm-hmm. But it also, we're talking about contrast, it also contrasts with sort of arguments within Protestantism over post-millennialism and premillennialism. When does the Christ return?
Right.
Before the millennium or after the millennium, which is a totally historical, temporally sequential expectation.
Mm-hmm.
It's within Orthodox liturgies, the apocalypse, the second coming, are inside the liturgies themselves. They're inside of every Sunday service.
So this is all, this drama of salvation, of incarnation, of resurrection, is of creation, in fact, and the second coming is all happening all the time.
Right now, right this moment, precisely. I mean, when we're within the liturgical service, it is happening. And that experience is going to form a way of seeing the world and going right. through the world.
Which walking is, back out into the world, out of that sanctuary, out of
yes.
that liturgy.
Yeah.
And this is so foreign, right? I mean, in terms to our culture and even to the way Christianity has infused American culture. It's a different way of being Christian.
Of course it is. Mm-hmm. I can get into all kinds of things that are happening in the culture, even within American religious culture, which would contrast with the way the Orthodox would read the Bible and experience the Christian life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, about how you would read the Bible and experience the Christian life.
Well, for example, I'm not particularly interested in conflating, correlating a reading of the Genesis account of creation with the latest scientific theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is science. I think of the first chapter of Genesis as a divine litany. Something is happening, and then God says, as a respondent, he takes both the role of liturgist and respondent.
Mm.
He says, "This is good," or "This is beautiful." Actually, the Hebrew word tob could mean either good or beautiful, and the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was the Old Testament of the early church,
mm-hmm.
translates it beautiful in the Greek, not good.
So God saw what he had made, those passages, and it was, and as it's
and it's then
used
God
to
says,
it,
this
it's
is beautiful. That's the
it's
response.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, God is singing creation into existence. I think C.S. Lewis caught this, had his own deep sense of this when he wrote The Magician's Nephew, in which Aslan, the great lion, the great god lion, sings the creation of Narnia.
Hmm.
Brings Narnia into existence liturgically in hymn, in song. It just seems to me that way of understanding creation is different.
Mm-hmm. It is different and simply would...
It means that that the song never ends.
Hmm.
The creating never ends. After all, you read in the book of Revelation... That the liturgy of creation is still going on, but it's of the new creation,
mm-hmm.
and words have been added to the song, but it's still the song. And think about throughout the Old Testament, from Genesis through the prophets, the creation itself is really depicted as a great temple in which worship is to be done. God sets the foundations. God stretches the heavens as a canopy.
Hmm.
God seats himself in the throne and all of that. And we're here to make the song of creation, the liturgy of creation and new creation manifest, visible, audible in the world.
And again, those are very much, as you've been saying, those themes are also are very much at the heart of this time of year, of the Easter celebration. I know that for you, none of this is abstraction, right?
None of it's abstraction. If you're talking about the Christ event, look, you look at the Gospel of John, the mm-hmm. first chapter or so. That's a recapitulation of the 7 days of creation. If you look at it, you see that there's certain on the I believe it's the seventh day on which the wedding feast occurs. You can count that out. I mean, John is recapitulating the Genesis, but also he says that the Word tabernacles among us. He becomes the temple in which we worship and through which we worship. So that what I was saying about the temple in the Old Testament
mm-hmm.
is carried over into the New Testament and is carried over into the hymns and prayers of the Orthodox Church.
Right.
I'm not making it up.
No, and it is that everything is contained in in worship and sacrament. I mean, you've used a phrase that the utter realism of the sacramental action for you. I think that that also for you is embodied in aspects of liturgy and worship. And I'd like for you to talk to me about you know, some of these huge ideas that in fact happen for you in worship. Icons are one example of that. I don't know. Talk to me about how this is all embodied and something which in fact you do work with and live with.
I suppose you want me to talk about icons and in my writing, certainly, you'll find that I do theology differently than Protestants, certainly, but even most Roman Catholics. In Roman Catholicism, liturgical theology is separated off from moral theology, is separated off from dogmatic theology in a way that they don't relate as readily as in Orthodox theology. So that when I do when I'm speaking theologically or writing theologically, I'm not simply reflecting on discursive prose or systematic formulations of the faith by great theologians, but also on the hymns and on the images themselves.
And that's an experience that's going to be had by every worshiper as well, right?
Absolutely.
Not just because, in a theological academy.
Yes, because quite clearly, if you begin to look at the Orthodox liturgies and rites, and I don't just mean the Eucharistic liturgy, but the sacraments and the feasts, the feast days and so forth and so on, the hymns and prayers correlate with the images that are in the church, the iconography that's in the church. Now, I must say that in my own tradition, the iconography can be rather sparse. We don't have an iconostasis in the Armenian church the way the Byzantines, the Greeks, the Russians, the Romanians, et cetera,
and
do
translate
at the front
that
of the altar.
For someone who hasn't heard of
iconostasis. Well, in most of Orthodoxy, you have a screen or a wall that stands in front of the altar, which is in the back of that screen, and you can see through a door. Sometimes you can see through; it's half partly transparent. It depends on the way this has been built. But you have images certainly of you're going to have essentially you're going to absolutely have to have an image of Christ. You're going to have an image of the Holy Mother of God, the Theotokos. You're going to have an image of John the Baptist, an image of the saint whose name is given to this church. You're going to have, and then beyond that, you're going to have images of other saints and even scenes from the Bible, icons that represent certain feasts. For example, we don't have a resurrection icon where Jesus is emerging from the tomb, sort of flying in the air, because there's no description of that scripturally. What we have are two icons. One is the icon of Christ's descent into Hades or hell, bringing Adam and Eve and all the saints out of the Sheol, out of the realm of the dead, into the new heaven on Saturday, and we have an image of the empty tomb with the visitation of the women coming with the myrrh or the oil on Sunday, on Easter Sunday morning. Now that's if it's Easter, there's going to be a focus and attention upon those icons within the church, and they may be at the very front of the church in the iconostasis, this screen or wall, or they may be in other locations, in the ceiling, on the sides of this church.
So talk to me about why, for you, those icons are important, what they do.
Because we human beings are not simply visually are not simply oriented by one sense or two senses. Mm-hmm. They're oriented by several senses. And so in order for the human being to be wholly engaged, all of those senses ought to be at work. And in some sense, one of the jobs of a Christian is to, in point of fact, hone the senses, reform the senses, make them holy. And that process can take place within a church, certainly, where everything is focused on God, so that the incense appeals to the sense of smell. The whole body's involved. Mm-hmm. The kneeling, the prostration on the ground, on the floor, the images that one sees, the songs that one hears, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And that engages the whole human being. Well, that's consistent with the Christian belief in the bodily resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
The whole self, not just some disincarnate soul.
And I have to say that something that I've, and you know, the liturgies are so beautiful. The music is so beautiful. That's something anyone can hear and feel exalted by. I think, you know, icons and incense are something that can be, that one needs to attune oneself to, perhaps. Something I've always been intrigued by, though, in my conversations with Orthodox Christians is how these lofty, this attunement to the senses is also very earthy, also has a very earthy side. It's not all just about gorgeous images in worship. And, you know, I wanted to read this passage that you quoted in your book, Incarnate Love, which of course is a central theme of the Easter story. And, you know, the example you use of talking about this is how it was articulated by Dostoevsky's Ivan Karamazov, right?
Mm,
and
yes.
You wrote, you know, the quote is, and you know, this is one of the ways that you also think about the meaning of these a large concept, incarnate love. He said, "Aloysia, my boy, so I want to live and go on living, even if it's contrary to the rules of logic, even if I do not believe in the divine order of things. The sticky young leaves emerging from their buds in the spring are dear to my heart. So is the blue sky, and so are some human beings, even though I often don't know why I like them. I'll get drunk on my own emotion. I love these sticky little leaves and the blue sky. That's what you don't love those things with reason, with logic. You love them with your innards, with your belly."
Yes, and of course the irony, which is so often a device used by Dostoevsky, is that the principal atheist who's rebelling against God in the novel is articulating precisely what the Christian experience is or ought to be.
Hmm.
So there's an irony there, and the question is whether how much Ivan actually believes that. But yes, absolutely, he's speaking a truth.
You're saying
there.
He feels it, whether he would articulate it in that way.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's a beautiful rant. I believe he's also glossing a poem by, is it Schiller there, mm-hmm. with the sticky little leaves. But
right.
But unquestionably, there are several levels to that. Language and speech by Ivan, but one level certainly is Dostoevsky is presenting us with an image of religious experience, which is Orthodox,
mm-hmm.
or Russian. Mm. He would say Russian,
but you would say Orthodox.
Yes.
You have suggested as a theologian that one distinction between a Western Christian faith and an Eastern Christian faith, particularly around themes of Holy Week and Easter, is that in Western Christianity, there is what you call a therapeutic vision of salvation. In Western Christianity, there's a juridical metaphor for salvation, but in Eastern Christian faith, there's a therapeutic vision of salvation. Now, translate that into lay terms and tell me why that's important to you.
Well, the there are a number of images or metaphors through which the gospel writers, St. Paul, and the early church fathers and mothers try to come to terms with that mystery, which is salvation, our atonement through Christ, the gift of immortal life that is given to us by God. In the West, particularly from the late Middle Ages on, there begins to become predominant one metaphor. It can be in various forms, but it is the juridical metaphor. The simple notion that here's how salvation or redemption is accomplished, that a great offense was done by Adam, so great an offense that it requires that no human being could possibly compensate for it or pay the penalty for that offense, that it would have to be the God-man or Jesus Christ, the Word incarnate, who would perform this act and meet the demands that are formulated in almost virtually legal terms, pay the price, pay the debt, whether to God or the devil. That certainly is a metaphor that is in Scripture and appears throughout Christian history, Christian thought, in liturgy, and so forth. But it's certainly not the only metaphor. There's Christ the Good Shepherd. There's also Christ the Physician. Mm-hmm. Now, in the East, these metaphors, there's less attempt to sort these metaphors out. The systematic impulses of certain Western theologies don't belong to the East, and particularly because the hymns dominate so much, and within prayers, within poetry, you can get away with a variety of metaphors,
right.
And in point of fact, they enrich the poetry or the hymns. And so I think that's one way of accounting for the fact that the Orthodox have not tried to separate out these metaphors. Well, anyway, there is a metaphor in the East which I think is more at the center of the Orthodox understanding of what happens. And it's not simply forensic or legal in the sense forensic, by which I mean God's disposition toward us is changed by that act of that one holy one who sacrifices himself for the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. Jesus on the cross.
Yeah, but that it's a physicalist interpretation, that Christ assumes our whole humanity, our whole human nature, and restores it to a state in which it can grow into holiness without obstruction. And in fact, he makes it holy himself, in his own self, by the kind of life he lives and by the death that he dies and his resurrection again after 3 days. So this is a metaphor which I've also called the therapeutic metaphor. Mm-hmm. There's a divine therapy in salvation. Through Christ, we are restored to wholeness. Not necessarily the state that Adam and Eve were in the garden before they fell, but something like that. Certainly in the Eastern tradition, to be contrasted, say, with certain Augustinian theologies in the West, the East does not regard Adam and Eve as perfect in the garden,
okay,
but potentially perfect. But they are unfallen, and they are without sin. And they can therefore grow into perfection as God has intended them to. So we're back to that potentiality. We have that potentiality again in Christ. We've been healed. Mm. Our wounded body has been healed. Mm. Our senses have been restored to be in tune with and in harmony with God's purposes.
And I think that that also leads into another very important distinction that you draw between Eastern and between Western Christianity and your experience and understanding of Eastern Christianity, that the resurrection shines through the crucifixion. It's true that in there are words like ransom, right, that yes. we associate with this, with these Easter images, with the cross and the blood of Christ. You know, I grew up Southern Baptist. There's so much of that imagery.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Of course, yeah.
Of the price he paid.
And his blood and so forth.
Yes, it's very... And that was also... You know, you've spoken about the about Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, which focused very much on that kind of blood and gore of the Easter story.
Yes, yes.
And the point you're making is not that that's not important, but that that resurrection is a theme that that frames your understanding, your liturgical experience of the crucifixion at Easter. Is that fair?
Yes, I believe you're referring to an essay that I was,
right.
I gave you in manuscript, mm-hmm. which will become part of a book very soon. But I've spoken about it in other places and written about it in other places, which is the kind of images of the crucifixion that are normative in the East and were in the West up until, again, the late Middle Ages, running into the Reformation. And the early iconography of the crucifixion, of which we have few examples, although it gets... It repeats itself in my tradition, maybe more than even in the Byzantine on occasion. Christ is on the cross and he's virtually standing upright and his arms are straight out on the cross. And his eyes may even be open. The wounds, if they're there, are merely puncture wounds. What is that but to represent the victory on the cross, but also... within that image is the resurrection, because the Gospels are written from the standpoint of the resurrections. If they had been written as a journal, they wouldn't look the same, would they? Because the disciples did not even believe and did not want to even hear Christ when he said that I must die and be resurrected in 3 days. And when the event actually happened, they all fled.
Right.
So the early church was not so much concerned with realism or naturalism. Now, naturalism is a better term. Christian realism, I think you could describe it as Christian real. The reality is that this was the Son of God, wholly divine, who became human and would exhaust death on the cross. The victory is won on the cross, and the resurrection in the early iconography wants to emphasize that in such a way that you would have to say that this iconography is done from the point of view of the resurrection, and the resurrection shines through it so that even his eyes are open.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some iconography like that, which is even more dramatic. And I have instances of it in the Armenian church where the traditional skull of Adam, because legend has it that Christ was crucified in the very same place that Adam was buried, that skull you'll see in traditional iconography, East and West, and sometimes the blood is dripping on it. That blood will restore us to, we who live in the old Adam at this moment, perhaps, to life. But there's iconography in which the eyes of that skull are open, as are the eyes of Christ, which is not the kind of images of the crucifixion which we're used to seeing.
Where we dwell on presently. The agony and the horror.
Absolutely.
And the death.
Now, even when the agony was taken up in later iconography, Christ, he may have his eyes closed, he may be sagging, but it's not gory, And you have a sense that there's a sleep there, and that there is a kind of peace there, a promise of. And the resurrection still shines through that. When you get to later Western iconography and paintings and images of Christ, that the move to naturalism forgets all of that theology.
Mm-hmm. What?
And I think Gibson's crucifixion is an example of that. I called it a kind of moving iconography.
Right, and you suggested that when you saw Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ, you would have given it a different ending and a different beginning. And I think that those are consonant with this different theology of the Easter story that
I would have begun with a post-resurrection account of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, and Christ encounters them, and that they don't recognize him until they essentially break bread with him and eat with him.
Because for you think that we only should retell that story or want to retell the story of the suffering with the resurrection in mind first? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That and also my objection in the case of Gibson's film was I found the resurrection scene. First of all, you wouldn't have such iconography in the East, although there are examples of it late, very late, mm-hmm. but it's not normative of sort of either Jesus sort of flying out of the tomb or what Gibson did. Where you sort of see part of his body and you're reminded that he's come back to life. It was in my eyes quite surreal, joltingly in contrast with the naturalism of the crucifixion scene, and I found it disconcerting and unbelievable. If you had left that scene out of the movie, what would you have been left with but a man who died on a cross? Big heart died for all of us somehow or other, but I don't know that the resurrection would have been in our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I would have told it quite differently. I would mm-hmm. have had the last scene be Christ on the cross saying it is finished, because it is finished. But what kind of finish is it? It's not finished on the cross per se. There's the resurrection that is happening on the cross as well. So... It would be appropriate to end with it is finished, and we wouldn't have just a tragic hero dying.
You know, the story, the Emmaus story, and the appearances of Jesus, often physically not recognizable, at least for a while, to the people he's encountering.
Yes.
After the resurrection. I think that you do consider those to be an important part of the Easter story, and it has always intrigued me since I did my study of theology and the Bible that those intriguing and very mysterious post-resurrection stories are not more a part of the narrative that's told and commemorated.
Yes, well, it ought to be. Another point I made about Gibson's movie, since many who listen will be familiar with that movie, is what I liked. One of the things I liked about it was the images, the repeated imagery of the Last Supper. But the Last Supper isn't just about a sacrifice. It's also about the resurrection. You remember, and even you remember the Second Coming, as I spoke about earlier. A number of those scenes, including the one we've spoken of, the Road to Emmaus, is Eucharistic in character.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the disciples recognize Jesus when they're having a meal with him.
When they break bread.
Mm-hmm. When they break bread, in effect. That's why I thought the movie would have been so much more powerful if that had been the start of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Eucharistic imagery, which is quite... I like it's well done, it seems to me, within the Gibson movie, as I recall it, would have had a connective with the very beginning and the very end that would have been so much more powerful. That's where we meet Christ and recognize him. And in point of fact, people say, well, would you believe that if Christ came again, tomorrow and appeared on Main Street, would you recognize him or believe him? Only if you broke bread with him.
Hmm.
Only if you keep breaking bread. Only if you keep the liturgy.
Hmm. I would like to talk about your garden, because it seems to me that in the writing you've done about gardening, that is a place where many of these themes, if you will, become three-dimensional, you know, or take
yes.
on flesh.
Yeah.
And
it's my favorite writing.
It's your favorite writing, and
oh,
it's beautiful writing. It's wonderful writing. And it, you know, and I think for you, and this does come from your Orthodox perspective, the story of Adam, the beginning of humanity in the garden, and the story of Easter are absolutely interwoven. Again, I don't think that that's something that Western Christians or our culture necessarily see or take for granted. Talk to me. Let's start talking about what you do in your garden, what you learn from your garden, the insights that come to you there that also, again, illustrate and kind of bring down to earth some of this theology.
Well, that's a whole...
It's a huge
yeah.
question. Where,
it's a
you know,
huge
where
question.
Would you start?
Well, I would start by saying, and this among some Christian communities would not only sound strange, but perhaps heretical, but it certainly belongs to the imagination of the early church and my own church, is that they're almost... There are, in a sense, two scriptures. There is the written scripture, and that's at the very heart of the church. But there's also the imprint of God on his creation, and the fact that were not God constantly willing his creation, loving his creation into existence, it would disappear. In a real sense, creation is this. It is the love, the will, the love, the imagination of God taking on existence and form. God stops willing, God stops loving, we disappear, in my view. We're on the head of a pin in that sense. And that, and the creation, the creative act of God, if you like, never ends, is constant. We live inside of God's own eternity, though we count the days.
And it seems to me that when you are in your garden, you feel yourself inside, both eternity and temporal existence.
It wasn't long ago that my son, who's recently gotten married to a young woman from Armenia, remarkable, in his third, fourth generation, whatever you want to call it, marrying someone right from Armenia. They met on ArmenianSingles.com or whatever it's called.
Really?
Yes, while she was here studying, and a 2-year romance over across oceans and great continents. But they were leaving one evening from our home in Culpeper, and we live still in the country, so that there aren't too many lights. And they looked up at the sky, and they live in Baltimore, right down Baltimore City, and inside of Baltimore City. And she commented, Hasmi commented, "My word, you can see the stars, you can see the heavens here." And we're all just staring up at that canopy up there, you know. Mm. People don't look up anymore; they don't have time. They sit in cars; you can't see up.
Right.
Unless you have your top down. That's why I have a Jeep. So I can do that at least 9 months, 7 or 8 months out of the year. Taking in the whole of it, permitting oneself to exercise one's senses again, you know.
Right.
Well, we drive on a highway, but what is it? We're on a conveyor belt. And we're not allowed to see much either. It gets even worse now because they put up these walls so that the sound doesn't get from the highway to people's homes. Mm. So what do we see? I mean, that might be a metaphor of modern life. Well, certainly that second scripture I'm talking about has been shut out from us. Mm. No, we've shut it out in ways that gardening opens up. I'm grateful that I can garden. Now, I in one of the pieces in The Fragrance of God called the Temple Transparent, I think I worked those metaphors up in just the way that I was explaining earlier on about the Old Testament sort of presenting the whole creation as a temple that God has set up for us.
Right. And that you really experience it that way.
I really experienced it, walking down that path, which I call my Wordsworthian walk, down toward Hungry Run, the stream, down at the bottom of my property, and just the bluest sky in December, and being able to see the trees reminding me of Gothic, you know, the Gothic arches. I felt as if I was in a great cathedral for a moment there. Hmm. And look, the images play in our minds and in our imagination. We don't have certain images. We're not going to see things that way. I mean, if I wasn't reading the text, if I wasn't immersed in Scripture as well, I wouldn't experience it that way. Nature and Scripture interpret one another.
Okay.
They're a diptych. I also say in my first book, Inheriting Paradise, that I learned more about my faith maybe in the garden than I did in the church.
Mm-hmm.
I was accenting something that occurs to me. It may be hyperbole, but there's a certain truth in what I said about myself when I said that.
I mean, here's something that, again, I think points to your orthodox sensibility. You said you believe that smell, not sight, is the most mystical sense, and the garden is one place that that affirms that belief in you.
Yes.
Talk about that.
Oh. Well, again, maybe a bit of hyperbole, but certainly, I think, defensible. Seeing is so easy. And, you know, if I'd seen the resurrection, or if I'd seen this, or if I'd seen that, I'd really believe, you know. We don't say if I'd smelled it. Smell keeps the mystery. It reveals the mystery, but it doesn't fool us into thinking that we would believe in it or explain it if only we could smell it.
Hmm.
And it comes to us with surprise, doesn't it?
Hmm.
Now, I suppose my dogs wouldn't feel the same way. They probably wouldn't describe that as the most mystical sense. Maybe sight is.
For them.
For them.
Well, because they live more practically with their sense of smell, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. There it is. I mean, I'm walking in my garden, and all of a sudden, overnight, something has bloomed. Maybe the honeysuckle. Oh, maybe the rugosa roses. Or maybe it's just the cabbage in the vegetable garden. And it surprises me. And I don't even see it, but I know it's present. I feel its presence. No, I smell its presence. I'm aware of it. Well, for many of us, that's an experience like that of experiencing God in prayer.
Mm. You know, you wrote in one place, much like the rose I sensed in the nursery, God is mysteriously present in our lives. Although I had forgotten the scent and the rose was out of view, its fragrance awakened me to its presence. We may not see God face to face or tangibly experience him in other ways. Nonetheless, he avails himself to us as he did to Adam and Eve in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Adam and Eve in the gardens, their senses were fresh, not adulterated. That's the way I read pre-fall in human existence, shall we say. There's existence in the garden, in paradise.
And I think it is so interesting that you experience yourself there in your garden. I mean, this metaphor or this story of paradise and of, you titled your first book about your garden, Inheriting Paradise. But
yes.
In your garden, that whole story becomes real to you.
Yes, and in Inheriting Paradise, the narrative is kept up in so much as I write these pieces on important feast days of the church and sort of take you through the calendar, the church mm-hmm. calendar, the church year, so that the narrative is inside of the pieces and also belongs to the entire ensemble of what I've written there. Yeah, narrative is very important. I've grown to appreciate the value of it more as I've aged, because one looks back on one's life and we inevitably think in terms of narrative. There's something fundamental mm-hmm. about that. Yeah. And it is in the Orthodox liturgies. I know that one time the well-known Protestant Methodist theologian Stanley Hauerwas, when so-called narrative theology was very big back 10, 15 years ago, said to me, Vigen, you don't have to do narrative theology. It's in your liturgy. It's mm-hmm. in your worship. Right. It's in your prayers.
Right.
We Protestants, we've got to try to recover it. We've forgotten how to tell stories, but you're telling it every day in worship.
Mm-hmm. But talk to me just in a basic way about how your love of your garden and all the time you've spent there over the years, and what the central place it has in your life, you know, how that makes you think differently about this idea of paradise and the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I probably run wild with metaphors, but
that's kind of who you are. That's okay.
and I get misunderstood a lot. Be very careful what metaphors you use these
days.
We're really quite deaf to metaphors in this culture. I mean, newsprint and news conferences and so forth don't have much use for metaphors. It's left to rural folk to still keep up the metaphors.
Okay.
When I get into the garden in the spring and I'm getting ready for it here, it comes pretty early in central Virginia. What am I doing? I'm during Lent in particular. I'm digging out weeds that have died. I'm cleaning out the garden. It's a messy business and it's not terribly pleasant. But what is the reward for that? You know, the sacrifice is more than worth it. And in the process of doing this task, which one would rather avoid on certain days in particular when the weather isn't so great, perhaps, in the task of the very doing it, my senses are being brought alive.
Right.
And
right.
And that means that I'm going to my experience of I'm tuning my body. I'm cleansing my soul. I'm making myself ready to receive the gift.
Mm.
And it may be in the first blossom of a peony, you know. What a wonderful flower. They don't last very long, but when they're there, they're something else. Mm. And they just pop up out of nowhere. Just a little bud, and all of a sudden it's huge. Mm. Enormous, beautiful, fragrance. Yeah.
Mm.
The problem there is that the peonies don't take a whole lot of care. They don't need a whole lot of care, so that's probably not the flower to choose.
Okay, choose
but
another one.
You get the point.
I get the point.
Well, yeah, I think anybody who raises roses. Now, I particularly those who actually do cultivated tea roses, which in this climate where I am, I just avoid. I use the old-fashioned roses, the rugosa roses, going back to the earliest rose, really,
mm-hmm.
which is on the cover of the Fragrance of God.
Right.
Rosa Gallica officinalis, the apothecary rose. It was in the monastic gardens,
wow.
The hip that grows out of it, you know, and so forth. But yeah, certain flowers are better for that metaphor.
Okay. I think I didn't do this when we started talking about your garden, but I think I'd like for you to just tell me about it. Just kind of walk me through it in words, if you would.
What's that? Walk you through which one?
Tell me about your garden.
You want me to describe it?
Yeah, I do.
In some sense,
I do.
Well, okay. We bought a piece of property about 6 years ago at the foot of the Blue Ridge, in north central Virginia. It is a piece of property that naturally slopes down toward Hungry Run, which is a stream at the bottom of the property. It's about 5 acres. When the house was being built, I had a guy come in with a backhoe who was an artist with it, a sculptor, really. And what he did in the back of the house, which is an old-fashioned, looks like a Cape Cod with three dormers coming out and a big front porch with the pillars, not a big house, but suits the history and landscape, in my view. I mean, that's what's so sad about so much of modern architecture and how the homes that are being built today. Mm-hmm. No sense of somebody's got them graphed out somewhere, no respect for the lay of the land or the rolling hill or the flatness of it, no respect for whatever it is. We tried to work with the land, although we had to have him come in, and basically what he did was grade down the back so that there's a kind of rolling terracing going down ultimately into a meadow. And then behind the meadow, there's a scarf of woods, young trees, relatively young trees, has maybe 200 feet depth, and then you're at the border of my property, which is Hungry Run at the back. And so he having done that, I began, even as the house was being built, to plant my perennial beds on the terraced property, and down below it to put my kitchen garden, vegetable garden, fairly large. Mm-hmm. But the vegetable garden itself is deep dug and in various shapes, So we have triangular beds and square beds and circular beds, and mm-hmm. paths that are going through them. What I've learned over the years in just vegetable gardening is that a vegetable garden can be just as beautiful and rewarding to the eye and the smell as a flower garden. But anyhow, so you start with the three levels of free-flowing but terraced perennial beds with some mix of annuals in there to keep the color up. And lots of shrubs and tall grasses mixed in, flowering shrubs and tall grasses mixed in. Well, it's rather large. I mean, the largest bed on the top terrace is probably about 65 feet by 20 feet. And there are these other free-floating beds. Some are elongated and so forth and so on. And there's paths crisscrossing them. Mm. So it's a rather lot of... There's a lot of garden there.
Right. And you moved... You had an extensive garden in your home before
in Reisterstown, Maryland. Reisterstown, Maryland.
You
yes.
moved. You moved into this house during Holy Week.
Yes,
and you
that
moved
wasn't
the
planned.
Garden too, right? Or you moved part huh? of the garden. You moved part of. You,
oh yes,
you took
I brought
a
my,
lot of the garden with you.
Yes, I did. We'd actually moved into my brother-in-law's house. He's an angel to have had us as long as it ended up. But yes, when we moved from Reisterstown to my brother-in-law's, I filled up a small truck, rented truck, just with plants. And as I record in one of the pieces in the Fragrance of God, I assume that some people might have thought that was profligate and quite silly, but. But I took the garden with me, not only because plants can be expensive, but because there were memories attached to a number of these plants. The rhubarb that came from my grandfather's garden, that went to my father's garden, that went with me from one house to another, I brought to Virginia with me, back to Virginia with me. right. other fruits and other flowering plants that were given to me by certain people or hold memories that take me back to my childhood experience even, or remind me of people who gardened that I knew as a child particularly.
You know, and when you write about the garden, and again, the beginning of the Christian story of Adam and the garden, which begins in a garden, and even again thinking about Easter and Christ as the new Adam. I mean, I feel like that story is very present to you in your garden, and you often cite Armenian apocryphal Adam literature that also informs your thinking about that. I mean, it's quite intriguing. I'd like for you to just tell me a little bit about that and how that also maybe shapes your religious understanding of what happens there differently.
Yes, well, particularly in two of the essays or reflections in The Fragrance of God, that's true. The last one, Resurrection Garden, there is one of those stories told. That apocryphal literature, you find it in some of the ancient tongues. It is still remembered liturgically. You have echoes of it. When I say apocryphal, we mean that it's stories that really are, in one sense, interpreting and trying to imagine what more there was, say, that was going on in the garden, or what happened when Adam and Eve were expelled, and where to whence were they expelled, and how did they feel about that? This is true of Jewish.
Yes, it sounds like it's a bit like Midrash.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is a Midrash, mm-hmm. And in fact, while I'm not an expert on this, I assume that some of this apocryphal literature takes up themes directly from what was known by the early church of this Midrash or this.
So it was really picking up Jewish interpretation and stories in Midrash.
That's my guess.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. In any case, it's in the same style,
mm-hmm.
And you find it particularly among the ancient churches in the Syriac, for example. You're going to find the similar stories, and those stories can be wonderful. They're wonderfully poetic and bring great feeling into one's experience of the scripture themselves. So. I felt it was natural to incorporate that, particularly the apocryphal literature about Adam and Eve when they're expelled, and their memories of the garden, and that kind of story is informative and reminds me and is comforting of the fact that I feel the same way in the garden. You know, that my garden isn't perfect either. I mean, it's I labor here, and I would like it to be paradise, but it's not. But maybe some of paradise is inside of my garden. Mm. And, you know, my favorite of all the early church patristic writers, and it's pretty clear from what you see in The Fragrance of God and Inheriting Paradise, is Ephrem the Syrian, who mm-hmm. lived in the 4th century, who was... wrote mostly hymns.
Okay.
Incredible hymns that are very much like this apocryphal literature, and it's so rich and so colorful and very unlike contemporary modern academic theology, which in my view is so dry and in many ways so impoverished because it's impoverished of metaphor.
Well, is there a passage or are there some words of Ephrem the Syrian that come to mind? I mean, I know I can find that in the book, and we can actually put it into that. We can produce it into the program. But is there something special?
You mean that I've memorized?
Or that you're thinking of, or some idea that comes from him, his writing?
Well, for example, the notion that paradise is still there, we don't see it. But some of its fragrance wafts into my garden. He expresses it just that way.
Okay.
It's not entirely gone, paradise. There are pieces, we experience it in this fallen world as well. Yeah, that's...
What's kind of interesting to me, so when I see you writing about the fall, and you just said that maybe some of this ancient Armenian apocryphal literature was taken from Jewish tradition or was an interpretation of that, which would make sense. And I do hear this theme coming through. I think in Jewish theology, there's not so much the fall as the exile from the garden. And I also hear that sense in you, that experience in your garden.
Yeah. So, well, I think that's quite right. Exile. I mean, I think that's an early experience of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it has to do with the fact that the early church was persecuted also. I mean, you can't stay in Jerusalem or whatever. I mean, I'm just speculating. I mean, in terms of my own Armenian identity, obviously, it's the fact that so much of our Armenia is in diaspora.
Yes.
And has been in exile one century after another for one reason or another. But in modern life, certainly, that holds true.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean,
and,
exile.
And it's probably working on me quite unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first time I ever stepped foot in Armenia, it was next to a mystical experience. I arrived early in the morning as the sun was coming up. I'd flown in from Moscow, and I felt as if I'd landed on a different planet. Maybe it was just the climate or something, but there was something else going on inside of me. I've never had quite that experience again going back to Armenia, but that first time, I don't mean to make too much of it, or collective memory or whatever it might be, but yeah, it was like I returned home. I'd never been there.
Hmm. How old were you when you first went there?
40.
Huh.
About 40 years old.
But, I mean, was it just the feeling that you had standing there, or was it what you saw and heard and smelled around
you?
Well,
yes, it was what I saw and heard. There were a few people around. They all looked like me.
Okay.
I looked like them.
Right.
They were speaking a language that... I heard less and less and spoke less and less into adulthood. There was a certain carriage of the people, the way they walk and talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why Americans are so easy to... We think we're the whole world. So when we go someplace else and people can pick us out, it's not just the clothing we wear. I think people attribute it to that. I think it's the way we move also.
Right. But what was it that made you think about coming to Armenia for the first time and thinking about the fall and the garden and exile? Was it that theme of exile? I mean, is that another way in which some of these large themes of Christianity are made real in your life?
I suppose there was every bit of that in it. But remember, when I arrived in Armenia in 1990 for the first time, it was not long after the earthquake,
right,
of December 1988.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons I wanted to visit. And another reason was there was much turmoil at that time. Even before the Baltic states began to rise up, Armenia had partly because of the threat, because of the Nagorno-Karabakh issue, that piece of property that was put into Azerbaijan by Lenin at the time, or Stalin, really, in order to reduce the size of Armenia as much as he could. And after all, Stalin was a Georgian. He knew what Armenians were about.
Okay.
They were going to want to keep every bit of that historic land that they could, and he didn't want them to grow too big. So there was that issue, the general glasnost at the time that was being absorbed in Armenia and articulated in ways that were quite bold. And my grandparents, who had lived for the day when Armenia would be a free and independent nation, all of that brought me back to Armenia in 1990 and 91.
And, you know, as dramatically and poignantly as any group, I suppose Armenian Orthodox Christians have lived these great themes of suffering and resurrection that that are in the Easter story at this time of year.
Well, certainly in modern times, I mean, yes, but you know, I leave you free to articulate that. On the other hand, we can be too exclusive about claiming that mm-hmm. for ourselves, but it certainly is true. I mean, look, I mean, there's no question but that at least 1 million, if not 1.5 million Armenians died in a matter of a few years around the time of the First World War, and that was half the Armenians in the world. That's incredible, and, you know, an enormous catastrophe, and it's had ramifications and reverberations into the fourth generation.
But I mean, here's
it's
the hard...
It's a great wound. It's a great
it's
wound.
A great
you
wound.
Grow up with it. It's passed on to you.
Right. And, okay, so here's what I want to ask you about. I mean, how that pushes at your theology, because it's when we began talking, you spoke about how, you know, the resurrection is happening now. It happens in worship. It happens in liturgy. And in Orthodox liturgy, there is this sense that the church transfigures the world, and yet in Armenian experience, that contrast between what happens in liturgy and what has happened in the world repeatedly is very stark.
Yes, I suppose that is stark.
Yeah, and I mean, so talk to me about that.
Well, look, I mean, the human spirit is next to indomitable, in my view, and whatever that memory is of paradise that we have keeps us alive. I think Armenians are blessed with a kind of imagination that is so cosmic in a way. It's true of the Middle East, not just Christians. It seems to me Islam expresses itself that way. It's particularly true of the Middle East. So is it not surprising that the ancient Hebrews produced the Psalms, you know, or the Song of Solomon, you know. Mm. I mean,
these works
this
of
kind
great
of,
beauty. These
yes, oftentimes reflections of those who have suffered or been in exile themselves, enormous suffering and lengthy exile and removal from that place which is inside of them and which they wish to return to. So there's nothing highly exclusive about this, but I do think in the case of Armenians they have a treasury of poetry and hymnography. I mean, the theology of my church, more so than the Byzantines, it seems to me, more like the Syrians, mm-hmm. is in its hymns. They're not just those who are would read those hymns that are not familiar with the tradition would say, "Really, is that a hymn?" It's so rich, not only in metaphor, but deep theologically, mm-hmm. these hymns, and they can go on for a long time.
And we will be able to play some of those hymns, and I love that idea. But, you know, I want to press you because I think, sorry, you know, here's something you've written as a theologian about the Easter events that, you know, that you see that history and nature are shot through with God's purpose and grace.
Yes.
And
well,
how can that be expressed? How can that be true within Armenian experience that we're
talking
about?
Well, you can build a garden most anywhere.
Okay.
I mean, you go to the Middle East, not just Armenia, but certainly in Armenia. You go even into Yerevan in the back of these horrendous apartment houses, there'll be a little plot with a... And inevitably you'll have a grape arbor and you'll have some fruit trees. They brought the country what you see in the villages still, I mean, profound. I mean, it's beautiful to see how village life is oriented to the land and to the seasons. I mean, it's a hard life, but I think the people in the villages today in Armenia live better than the people in the city, from my point of view.
So I think you're
saying it's a very hard life. Mm-hmm. But you can create a garden most anyway, and anywhere. And one of the things I wanted to say is that if I remember the church, I also remember the gardens of my great aunts and uncles, and of people I called uncle or aunt that who weren't uncle or aunt, but they were Armenian, that whose homes they visited, and in every case they wanted to show you the garden. I mean, that was obligatory. You might go inside and be greeted, but then you go right outside and go into the garden. And I can remember this over and over again. Now, why were they building these gardens? Was it just simply because they wanted the fresh fruit? I don't think so, ultimately. But I was too young to ask those survivors, and many of these were the survivors of the genocide.
Mm-hmm.
Why they were doing this?
What is your answer to that question now?
I have my suspicions. I think that they were in part bringing part of the old country over with them. There were memories of the garden that they had. I think that also the garden was a place where things came to life. It wasn't, in point of fact, a reaffirmation of life and something to sustain faith, hope, and to go on living.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. It's very closely related to the other phenomenon, which I think other ethnic groups could probably probably say, well, we had something similar going, but they were expelled or in exile too. I mean, mm-hmm. everybody comes to America for these sorts of reasons. But it was that you got fed. I mean, it wasn't you could not, you had to open your mouth and be fed. I mean, that was, and what was that about? That was about, look, you know, you're not going to starve like my parents did or I did in the desert or in the wilderness,
and,
on the death marches, or whatever it might have been.
Is the answer to that question about how history and nature seem shot through with God's purpose and grace is that is constantly recreated in the midst of and despite and after these experiences of
Well, remember the story I told about one particular priest who led his people out of the men out of the village, they had no bread or wine, certainly, and so, but they were going to hold the Eucharistic commemoration, and they ate the dirt.
Hmm.
I mean, from earth to earth. And he said, "This cursed earth, but it is, you know, but it's blessed.
Hmm.
That can be blessed. The curse can turn to a blessing. The earth does sustain us, and we are of the earth. And so, there's a lot to be read out of what that action was all about.
Mm-hmm.
These men were probably going to die, either marched to death or shot.
Right.
They were going to stop and do this with this priest, and he was going to do it.
And I'm wanting you to put a point on that, I'm wanting you to say what that means for you theologically, how that informs your theology, how that informs your experience of the Easter story.
Well, what I'm saying is that the resurrection is alive in the faith of those who are with us presently and have been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
I think the resurrection has been with us even before it happened.
There's that.
I mean, after all,
nonlinear sense of time.
Huh?
There's that nonlinear Orthodox sense.
Absolutely.
Of time.
Absolutely. I mean, who is Jesus Christ? He's the divine Word, the pre-existent Word of God. He is the Lamb who has been slain from the foundation of the earth, which is to say that it's all very present.
You do also make this point in your garden about time, about beginnings and endings and the temporal and the eternal,
yes,
and the relationship between those being so clear.
Yeah, I suppose I say it in many places. Mm-hmm. I don't know what place you're thinking of in particular, but yes, I do say it. I say it through not discursively so much as mm-hmm. Through the presentation of images and the telling of my movement mm-hmm. in the garden, or my relationship to certain things in the garden.
Tell me one of those stories, just one of those stories, maybe to end. For someone who hasn't read the book.
Well, there's one story of the fact that I found in the woods in Maryland the wildflower. Oh well, wait a minute. We got to start all over again because I'm going blank on what it was, which flower it was.
It's all right.
The bloodroot. That's right. It was the bloodroot, I think. Yes, there's the wildflower. To answer your question, the bloodroot flower blooms very early in the spring, around the time of Lent and Easter, depending on when Easter falls. I found a grove of these in a wooded area not far from my home in Reisterstown, Maryland, and I transplanted them by an oak tree in a partially shaded part of my yard in Reisterstown, where there was also a slate path leading out toward my vegetable garden. And my experience of the first blooming, the first time that those transplant bloomed, I'll really quite never forget. The reason why it's called a bloodroot is because the flower, the root itself, if you press it and break it, you'll get a red dye. Mm. It can be used as a dye. Mm. But the bloom itself only lasts a day. But it comes out of this, as I described it, out of the sepulcher of the earth, and what it leaves is these sort of heart-shaped flowers, heart-shaped leaves. That is a microcosm of resurrection for me. I have a wild imagination, you know. I mean, I've described the stakes in my vegetable garden in the wintertime as crosses on which bodies are draped. You know, I don't mean that in a gory sense, but I see crosses in trees. Okay. Or in the geese flying in the air.
Right.
In the formation of what? A V, a sign of victory. The geese in the sky remind me of the crosses that pilgrims have carved into ancient Christian sites, which if anyone goes to ancient Christian sites, you'll often find this, that the pilgrims have carved little crosses into, and there's hundreds of these in certain locations. Well, the geese remind me of that. The geese remind me of the cross. I think there are signs of the cross in all over creation. Mm. I mean, but that look. I mean, how do you account for that? Well, clearly we've forgotten. We've forgotten paradise. We forget God, and that's why I think we have Scripture.
Okay.
To remind
and,
us.
And you mean the Scripture that is written down and the Scripture of nature?
Yes, absolutely. I think that we cannot do without one or the other. Look, we have to live somewhere, and that's the world that we live in, and that world the Creator is imprinted and has imprinted himself in so many ways into that world. But we can be very blind to that imprint. And so God has revealed himself through the prophets and ultimately through Jesus Christ, and this has been recorded so that we do remember. And then the world again can be an epiphany for us. Now, I don't say that without Scripture, there cannot be a sense of a divine that is evoked by nature or by the creation. Mm-hmm. I prefer the word creation. I think there's evidence of that throughout human experience. But it's brought to a point by the revelation that is ours as Christians, mm-hmm. and is shared by Jews and Muslims.
Mm-hmm. And for you,
it's part of it.
And you've been, for you, it takes place within this very rich and long tradition that I think wonderfully brings together the large ideas and earthy experience. Yeah. Well, I feel like there's a lot more we could talk about. I wonder if there's anything else you'd want to say. I think we've ended in a good place, but is there anything I didn't ask you or anything else you wanted to say?
Oh, no. I mean, there's so much there.
I know. I know.
How much of this is actually going to be?
Well, we have a real conversation and it's not linear, and that's okay. And we will, it turns into an hour of radio.
Uh-huh. And so we've been on the phone for...
We've been on the phone, and we will edit it down, and I will... You know, there's a lot of...
Well, look at your notes. Is there anything... I mean, if you want to. I mean, is there anything else that
I have a lot in my notes. I have a lot in my notes. What we didn't get to talk about was your idea of worship as ethics, worship as ethics, which I think, again, is a distinctly orthodox way to think about ethics, and
yes.
And I think it's a huge topic.
Yeah, I don't think that
that's we
well,
can't get it.
I can talk about it, but yeah. I think that the conversation we've had has its own mm-hmm. momentum, its
yes.
own
yes.
own direction, and I think we pretty much covered that.
Yeah.
There may be a moment or two in some of my writing that you'd want to pick out, mm-hmm. but
mm-hmm. no, I think this has been wonderful, and I thank you for taking the time, and I know that my producer will want to ask you about music. We'd love for you to suggest some pieces of music, and we will be able to lay those in. You know,
interesting.
So,
yeah. Well, we'll have to work with. I'll have to work with him on that.
Yes,
I'd probably contact one of our dioceses and see whether they can be of help in particular.
Okay. Yeah, we'll work on that. Maybe by email. And anything else, Mitch? No. Okay. I think we need to finish. Thank you again.
Okay.
It's great to talk to you again.
Yes, I hope I get to see you. I'm not sure that it'll be in June, but
okay.
If you're ever out this way, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
I haven't been out there for years. So.
Well, if you come to college,
I sort of miss it. I wish I could come.
It's wonderful.
I may still make it. We'll mm-hmm. see.
All
okay.
Right. Thank you so
God
much.
God bless.
Yeah, you
All
too.
All right, you bet.
Bye.
Bye-bye.